Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Hey guys, welcome back to Magic TV. My name's Craig. It is 9 o'clock, which means it's time for a Talk Magic. And today, it really should be Talk Mentalism, not Talk Magic, because I have with me one of the top mentalists in the country, somebody who is very prolific, released so many wonderful effects that mentalists all over the world use as part of their performing set, and also somebody who I've seen perform firsthand and is an incredible performer, absolutely a shining light when it comes to painting mentalism in the right way, and somebody who everybody knows. I am, of course, talking about the one and only Luke. How you doing, man? You okay?
I am great, Craig. Yeah, thanks for having me on, buddy.
No, you're more than welcome. I know how busy you are, and we're coming up into Christmas. It's getting into silly season. You're a very busy performer. So thanks for finding time for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. And we found time to chat recently, didn't we? We found ourselves at an event together a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. And I had a chance, obviously, before I started running around doing my thing, I've spoken about this on my channel. I got a chance to see you do some mentalism for the photographer there, I believe it was, and just watching you do something very, very simple, and it was really simple, but that guy was just blown away, absolutely floored. Like, you could just see, and this is a photographer who'd seen lots of magicians before, and he came over to you and he was like, hey, I haven't really seen a mentalist before, can you show me the sort of thing so I know how to capture it? And you just took his breath away with one of the simplest things, and it just shows that the power of mentalism and the simplest routines can have such a profound impact on people.
Absolutely. So, yeah. I'd never met the photographer before, and I sort of followed him afterwards. And when I logged onto Instagram after the gig, I saw that he'd followed me. So I followed him and sent him a message just to sort of say, thank you. You know, if you've got any shots or anything like that, do send them on. I'll make sure that I tag you in everything, just to sort of try and build that relationship with him. But he sent a really, really nice message back. He enjoyed everything and looking forward to sort of working together. So it'd be nice if he sent some work my way and vice versa. And, you know, that's how it kind of works in a way, isn't it? Once people have seen you.
Exactly. But let's talk all about you. And before we start talking about everything that you do, because there is a lot that you do that I want to unpick, can we start off with your origin story? Like, it feels that your name has been synonymous with mentalism in this country for as long back as I can remember. But when did you first get into magic and mentalism?
I was talking to Alex Marsh about this the other day, and we said that we felt that we were the OGs in UK now. And it's crazy because I remember it feels like 2 minutes ago since we were just starting out and getting into it. So for me, how I got into, I came in via traditional magic, in particular coin magic. So I was a 14-year-old on holiday with my parents, and there was a magician just performing, but he was pitching a book. He was sort of selling things on this sort of street stand. And I remember it's the first time I'd seen magic close up and not on TV. My only sort of exposure to it was like Paul Daniels or, you know, Copperfield on TV on the Saturday night specials and things like that. So he held a coin, and he was very fair with the way he held it. And then he did this sort of thing, this sort of move with his hand. And I remember everyone's eyes just followed the hand. And in that moment, he did what he needed to do. And from it, he produced two giant coins. And it turned out it was an effect from one of the Mark Wilson, complete encyclopedia of magic or something like that. It was a little pocket-sized thing. And I was mesmerized with, not necessarily the trick, because the trick's the sort of ending and you think, wow, how has he got that? But then the natural inquisitiveness, I was sort of trying to reverse engineer it. And it all came back to that move with his hand. And I thought he needed me to follow his hand so he could get away with something in the other hand. And then you go on to learn about misdirection. And it was almost like a mental conductor of an orchestra just making people do what you want with gestures and things like that. And I was hooked at that point. I ended up getting the Mark Wilson book. And in that book, and my first exposure to like a mental magic kind of routine was a one ahead routine in there. And I think he just sort of started from there really and went off. I think for about 3 or 4 years, I was studying Bobo, T. Nelson Downs, that kind of old vaudevillian sort of coin manipulation. And that's what I really liked. And I've got a bit of an addictive personality. So when I get into something, I'll sort of, you know, jump 2 feet into it. And then when I was at college, and that's when I first heard of mentalism as a, you know, a standalone performance, almost separate in a way to magic. And I think at that point, Steve Shaw Banachek had just released the first printing of Psychological Subtleties. Before it was then collected as those three volumes set, there was just a very small, almost like Ladybird version of that book, very thin and spindly. And I spoke to Russell Hall at Magic Enterprises in Sheffield. And because that's my local town, so I went in, I said, oh, can I order this book? And it was like 6 weeks later, I got a phone call, came down, £30 for this book. And I remember seeing it, and it was the size of literally an A5 Ladybird book. And scratching my head thinking, wow, how is this one book worth £30? Read through it, knew nothing, understood none of it. So I almost felt a little bit cheated out of it. But I then found Bob Cassidy's work. And it wasn't because of the psychological subtleties that I felt cheated. It's just that I'd gone in at too high and I'd not known anything about the fundamentals of it. And that's when Bob came in. And for me, as soon as I found Bob's work, that was it. I was absolutely in love with mentalism, and I've not looked back since.
And at that, how old were you at that point when you found Bob's work?
Probably 20, maybe late teens, early 20s, that kind of time.
You'd spent a long time learning magic. Was it difficult to kind of just go, you know what? I love this aspect of the art so much. Everything I've learned with coins, whatever it may be, I'm going to push that to one side? Or was it kind of just like, no, this is what appeals to me. I have no problem doing this.
I would still practice coin slides. I would be, when I first got into, I would be going to sort of school, palming coins and seeing how long I could do them for to build the muscle memory up. I'd go into shops and I'd pretend to pay for change and sort of hand them empty hands and things like that. So it was very difficult to sort of wean myself off that behavior, what was becoming sort of memory based, like muscle memory. I was doing it to relax. You know, when you see people flipping pens or doing the coin roll, I found myself just like doing a French drop or a classic palm, just to sort of relax in front of the TV, that sort of thing. But when I got into mentalism to study it, the first thing I noticed is that a lot of things like billet switches were transferable, similar kind of moves. So it felt a natural progression for me to be able to take what I'd studied in the coin world and try to apply that to billets and other things. So I didn't find that I just stopped one day. It just became a seamless transition. It sort of flowed naturally into it. But I still find myself picking up coins today and playing around with them. I naturally reach for them now. But I don't find myself performing any of that. I think maybe there's been the odd time at an event where I've spoken and people have asked the difference between a magician and a mentalist, where I've used sleight of hand as a demonstration and then tried to make that link with sleight of mind. So, you know, if I make a coin vanish, you know that it's not really disappeared into the ether, that there's a trick to it, and often that you'll try and look and find that trick. But if I look at you and tell you your best friend from school, who you've not thought about for 20 years, there's still a trick to it. It's just a little bit more difficult to discern it or to sort of negate it as a trick, because it hits quite on a visceral level. So I still use it, but in a different way to create an example these days, I think.
That was going to be a question I asked. Do you find that coin magic and having a background in coin magic helps with mentalism? Because I've always thought that there's a bit of a crossover. You know, a lot of mentalists do billet switches. And you know, that feels a lot of the time a little bit like a shuttle pass or a coin switch. Do you find that having that grounding in coin magic was able to help you with billet work when you decided to kind of go full on with mentalism?
Yes and no. Yes, in that the physical dexterity, your fingers are trained to be able to isolate themselves and ligaments and things like that, which only comes through, you know, hours of practice, as we all know, just sat in front of a mirror and doing that. So yes, but at the same time, sometimes when you're learning a piece, or like, for example, a vanish or something like that, or a switch, the timings can be very different. You know, you might have to hide something like a billet switch. It works best when it's hidden in a natural movement that no one's even aware of. But the coin, we know when we're watching the coin, we're almost looking out for the coin, trying to follow the coin. So it's a different mindset as opposed to here's the billet and then they're trying to follow the billet. It's kind of different. So in one way, yes, it does help. But in another way, it kind of hinders as well. But not to the point where it'll stop you from doing it. You know, anybody can learn a billet switch, and then the real secret is to be able to sort of take that and hide it within a natural action that you yourself do, so it becomes second nature and no one even understands that anything's happened yet. You know, by the time you've done it, like the trick's only just starting. So,
and I want to talk more about your career, but I've got one other question while we're on this subject, which is, what's your view of magicians that perform magic and mentalism? Do you feel like it? Because if you remember, we just to give people a frame of reference, when we bumped into each other at this gig, I turned around to you and I said, hey, I'm not even going to do anything even that could be considered remotely mentalism, because I don't want to trivialize what you're doing.
Yeah,
and I don't really do mentalism. I kind of do mental magic sort of thing, but not really mentalism. Do you feel that if you're branding yourself as a mentalist, you can do a card trick or a coins across and then still be taken seriously as a mentalist? Or do you feel that when you do mentalism, you have to kind of fully embrace that?
It's a great question. I'm sure there's a lot more cleverer people out there that have got a better answer. The truth is, I mean, there's lots of different facets and way of thinking about this. I mean, from a purely from an egocentric point of view and thinking like, how do I feel about it? You are the first person and only magician I've ever done an event with what said anything remotely like that. Often I'll find that, especially over the past 10 years, that the line between magic and mentalism is really blurry now. Not in terms of your purists and understanding the theory behind it, but sorry about that. Just a van just coming flying past. But in a sense that everything is so accessible these days. You can buy mentalism in magic shops and vice versa. I've seen quite a lot of magic related things on mentalism stores and things like that. So, you know, apps allow you to do a myriad of different things, and everyone's using apps these days, or at least a lot of people have at least got one or two on the phones that can do strong magic illusions, but also do a mind reading or a prediction effect. So it becomes difficult to discern, especially from the point of view of an author, like the general public who's just at an event and they see someone comes up, they don't care about the difference between it. You know, it's so difficult to be a mentalist and not get associated with magic anyway. And for years, I used to really push home the difference between it. But then it was a double-edged sword, because no one ever searches to hire a mentalist online. So you have to kind of embrace the term magician a little bit in order to just to be seen on a Google search. You know, it's all right to get, you know, people to see you early on as a magician, but then they learn that actually this magician is a little bit different. He's doing this kind of thing. I have no problem with that at all. But at the same time, it is a double-edged sword, because you will always be pigeonholed as a magician. So I'm trying to undo maybe 10 years of work at the moment by distancing myself from that term as a magician, because naturally you get pigeonholed into that, and you also get put in a box in terms of perceived value, I think. And I know prices are an interesting thing, when lots of magicians talk about prices and things like that, but I think it's difficult to differentiate yourself in terms of prices and having a client understand the difference between one or the other. Often they just have a rough figure in their head and every magician should be that price. So it can be frustrating. But what can you do? You know, I was kind of briefly mentioned recently, I did a wedding fair and had a magician, a self-appointed magician and mind reader come up to me, who introduced himself, and he said that he'd been doing mentalism for 25, 30 years, and was quite blunt with him, almost suggested that we were at competition today, we were enemies to see who could get the most bookings, and that kind of stuff doesn't interest me in the slightest. I think it's pointless. You know, it doesn't matter how busy you are, you'll never do as many weddings as they are each year or each week in any country. So I find that there's a lot of magicians now that will say that they do mentalism or do parts of mental magic, but I don't honestly believe that they know the fundamentals of mentalism and the different. I think it's all one big pot, what's becoming blended into a huge mess.
I know exactly what you mean. It's a really good answer as well. Totally agree with you. 100%. So going back to your career, so you're 20 years old, you've now decided, or early, you know, late teens, early 20s, you've decided that, hey, mentalism is the way to go. Is the goal to become a professional, or did you have a different career path? And if so, what happened to eventually, because you are a professional, you're a full-time pro, you have been for many, many years. How did that all come about?
So at university, well, my sort of path went after school, I stayed on and I did A-levels, and then I went to college and did a year doing an arts foundation course. I've always been interested in the arts. And then through that 1 year, gave me an insight into design, graphic design, product design, because we had to, within that foundation course, we would do maybe like 6 weeks focusing on different areas. And one of them that I chose was design. So that introduced me to a whole new world of graphics and sort of being able to sort of sketch and draw. And I was kind of pretty good at drawing beforehand, but it's very stylistic, that sort of thing. So I got quite into that, to the point where I applied to go to a product design course at Sheffield Hallam, a 3-year bachelor's degree. I did that, loved every second of it. And then the sort of whole point of this was to go into design, to go maybe work for a consultancy, to create ideas, prototypes, that sort of thing. And it was quite exciting back in the sort of mid to early 2000s because the technology had really taken on and we were starting to see like the things we take for granted now, like even just 3G. I remember one of the projects that we had was 3G and Bluetooth are going to be coming in soon. This is what it can do. Created a project. So I was heavily into music at the time. I used to DJ for a hip hop group in Sheffield. So I was always into mixing and scratching music and things like that. So I designed a prototype for essentially an MP3 DJ decks. So you download the tracks from the music, from the internet and sync them up there, which back then everyone was like, well, maybe it'll work. But now when you look at DJs, that's literally, they take a laptop, they've got Serato on there, they're streaming the music from there. And it kind of went into that whole world. And now it's what we accept as a DJ and music. So that was nice to be a part of that. But after the 3 years at university, it comes a point there where, okay, you've got to get out into the big wide world. All the consultancy jobs were down in London. I'm very much a northerner at heart, and the idea of moving down to get a consultancy and then setting my life up in London, I wasn't interested in doing that. So magic was always the hobby. And at that point, I'm sort of moved into mentalism and learning about bits and bobs. And I heard an advert on a radio you could stay at the university for an extra year and do your PGCE course to qualify as a teacher. But it would also pay you to study. So I thought, well, that's going to give me a year where I'm being paid, but I'm still earning another qualification, and then I'll be a qualified teacher. So now I've got a couple of options here that I could go into. So I chose to do that, qualified as a teacher, and then did a year's supply at a school before being asked to go for an interview at a secure unit in Nottingham. So a secure unit is like think children's home that's all locked. So it's a prison and a children's home, but it's designed to keep the kids in because they'll be serving sentences for various crimes or on remand to go to court and things like that. So now I'm interested in something that's a little bit different. I'm still going to be teaching, but I'm in this kind of high risk area. And I'm still loving magic and mind reading. It was a tool to help with the kids as well. I could build the rapport with them very easy. And if they work with me at the end, I teach them like a simple trick, a little self-worker. So I just fitted into that role, and I was there for 14, 15 years.
Wow.
I knew I was going to transition out of it into being a full-timer, but I didn't make the jump from one to the other straight away. It was a very much a slow transition. So I did a full-time timetable at school. I used to teach there 5 days a week. That went down to 4 days, then 3 days. And in the end, I was just doing 2 days. The staff and the management were very supportive. They knew what the plan was going to be. And that was it. So by the time I went full time, I was already really busy doing the gigs because I'd spent time making sure I'd built a business up and had a client base already and had some reviews in place and people, you know, a good few years of experience actually going out and doing what I wanted to do full time, but just at weekends and evenings. And in a way, I would probably recommend a lot of people that have got that kind of goal to do it that way. And maybe, you know, maybe even don't or stick to still doing it part time and having a full time job, because, you know, when I went full time, even though I had a lot of clients waiting and they knew of me, it's you're swapping a whole one set of stresses for another. So, I mean, you know more than anyone, but having the comfort of a decent paycheck coming in each month, covering all the bills, the mortgage, everything, to that stopping. And now I'm like, you know what? I'm going to make sure I'm doing at least this many gigs each month before I'm at that even stage where I've got the additional income. Because when I used to teach, obviously the income came in, that was the bread and butter. And then, you know, the gigs were the gravy on top. So I just found myself swapping one set of stresses for another, but I wouldn't change it for the world, because the quality of life that I got back tenfold, you know, no more 5 o'clock starts in the morning and finishing at midnight when you've got a job on as well. So I feel like I'm rambling there. So
it's coming. No, I'm really glad you touched on this, because one of the questions that I get asked on this channel more than any other is, I'm semi-professional. I'm doing it as a hobby. I've done the odd gig or two. My burning desire is to go full-time pro. What should I do in order to make that happen? And what you just said there is fantastic advice. Make sure that you've got a client list. Make sure you built up a business before you actually take that leap. You know,
absolutely. And understand, I think more so than being a good magician, you know, I think John Archer said to me, like, if you remove the tricks, are you still an interesting person? Are you still engaging? Do people care and want to talk to you? And I think it's really good advice. So like, you could be really good. You have a huge repertoire, which is not necessarily a good thing, but, you know your material inside out. But at the same time, I wouldn't necessarily just focus on that magic side of it when you go full time. Really, you need to be a good business runner. You need to understand about marketing and understand where your clients are so you can target them. And that's the sort of stuff that you don't really get taught. So, you know, baptism by fire, once you're out there, you know that you've got to rely on yourself for no one else to be able to get those events. So be good at business first. Magician comes second. Eventually they'll merge together.
Absolutely, 100%. And when did you start gigging? Were you gigging during university and it just was an extension from there? When did you start?
Yeah, there was a guy who was doing his master's downstairs in this little, the Bachelors of Arts, they had all the floors in the uni, but there was one little private office where the master's students were. And he was a magician there. Can't even remember his name, it was that long ago, but I remember I kind of looked up to him a little bit. He was a bit older, so we'd spend time chatting and he'd show me things. And one night he said to me, he said, I've got a gig at Cutler's Hall in Sheffield. It's a nice, you know, center of Sheffield. It always tends to be a black tie kind of event there. And he said, do you want to come and help me with it? I didn't even have a suit at that point, you know what I mean? I had to go and buy a shirt, put a coat on. And that was my first ever gig. So I was kind of half magic and half, you know, trying out a few mentalism things. It was awful, absolute awful gig. But it gave me that experience to feel confident in that I know the material, but also to be able to walk up to a group, introduce yourself and have that kind of, you know, confidence to do that. So I think when you're in your early 20s, either you're a huge introvert or the other way around, aren't you? Either you're looking for the attention. So me, I was quite introverted. I found it quite awkward to speak to people and what have you. The teaching brought that out of me, I think. So a mixture of starting to do slow gigs and training to be a teacher really helped, became a catalyst in a way. Snowboarded and gave me that momentum and confidence to do it. But then at that point, it was, I'd find a venue where I performed at, and I stayed in touch with the venue. And then they'd say, oh, we've got a wedding fair on like next month. Do you want to come to it? I was like, oh, what do I need to do? And they said, oh, just get a banner. So I'm starting completely fresh. I had no idea about any of it. But it's all self-taught. You know, I did my first wedding fair, learned a lot from it, looked around, saw what other people were doing. And then you then try to apply that. So step by step, I sort of got myself to the point where, and I know I'm talking about weddings, but weddings were a big part of my early kind of client, really. That's the ones I went for. Just based on advice from a wedding planner who saw me, who said, I haven't seen anyone doing this kind of thing at weddings before. We get a lot of magicians, we get caricaturists and things like that, but we don't see any mind readers. So then I thought, right, I'll be the wedding mind reader. So that's what I spent almost 10 years really focusing on, and did pretty well out of it. You know, won a couple of awards and what have you. But I think for me, as I grew older, I wanted less stress, let's say. And weddings are very emotionally charged, and often they can be quite stressful times during the planning stages. And even on the day, you know, some of the stories, I'm sure you've got a million as well, but you sort of scratch your head. And I always knew corporate was the way to go in terms of one, decent fees, but you never get that sort of emotional engagement to the point where someone's so stressed about the event. Everyone's just there to do what they're doing, and it's much more civilized, I find. So that's where I've been trying to focus most of my energy on, at least since about 2019, really, 2020, just before the pandemic.
And correct me if I'm wrong. I'm pretty sure I'm right, but I might be wrong. You do an awful lot on stage now, don't you, as well? Like, and
that's where most of it's going to, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's the other question. I said that I get a lot of questions about how to become the pro. The other question I get is, how do I transition to stage? Because there's a lot of close-up magicians and mentalists that do walk around and the sort of thing that you and I did the other day, but their burning desire is to perform on stage. But the thought of walking out in front of like 100 people, 150 people, 200 people, walking out cold in front of a corporate audience that don't know who you are, thought of that scares the living hell out of them. And it is a totally different mindset and a totally different thing.
Absolutely.
What made you decide to move into that environment? And have you got any advice for people that do want to move into that environment?
I had no aspirations when I was just starting out to ever be on stage. Probably for the same reasons, that fear of everyone looking at you, that sort of going out and being the one person that everyone looks at. I was never really interested in that. And I would have bet money back then, with my mindset sort of 2014 time. I was like, no, I'm just going to be doing close up because I felt that I was good at it and I was understanding it and getting the reactions that I wanted as a mentalist. That big difference in terms of the perception of what it is that you're doing. So for me, I was like, no, this is me. And I had no classical training on stage. So I look at some people and I think they move around amazing on stage. It's very fluid. Their back's never turned and everything just sort of flows from one to the other. And I thought, yeah, whenever I do that, it's very clunky and disjointed. And I think realistically, obviously it's experience and it's confidence, but I think the older you get, you just become more comfortable in your own skin. So you start to care less about what people think and you're there to do a job and your job, you have to remind yourself, you're there doing what you love doing. This is what I wanted to do. So I've got no one to blame if I'm having a bad day or having a bad gig or something like that. I've got to go out and be the best I can be on that any given day. So when I found myself making that transition, there was a little pull that I didn't expect, a pull of, you can get away with a lot more on stage, like little things that you've read in books that you've never been able to try out because it's in a close-up environment and it doesn't work, but it translates on stage, and you get away with so much more. So I liked having that freedom. And it also inspired me to sort of develop those freedoms that I've not had in that close-up market for so long. And I was always told things like, you know, mentalism is not very visual. So, like, okay, I want to make it visual. Well, how do I make it visual? Well, I don't want to look at what everyone else is doing, because I'm just going to be going around and round and round, and we're all in that same pot. So I started to think about, well, what do I do when I teach? And I've got to tick on audio things. I've got to make sure that there's kids what are going to learn very well in an audio kind of, you know, from speaking, that parrot fashion sort of thing. Also our visual aids, because people are visual learners, and try and touch on the kinesthetic stuff as well. So I thought, right, well, I'm going to try and make my mentalism visual, and I'm going to try and approach it as I would as a teacher. So I wouldn't concentrate that much on being a purist on stage and have that theatrical background and training and being able to sort of walk the boards. And instead, I want to focus on just being a guy that talks as if I'm kind of giving a lecture or a fun lecture, what's got some demonstrations in there. And I found, because it was very closely related to what I did as a teacher, that they weren't that far removed from each other. So it came quite natural. So that is, but that's my approach. It's not going to work for everybody, but that's why I'm into it. I still feel like I'm kind of teaching, even though I'm not. It's kind of like fake teaching when I'm doing it now, in a way. But another thing that I used to get really nervous about, going out in front of large groups, and a good friend of mine, a guy called Mark Salem, he started off on Sesame Street. He was one of the psychologists behind the puppet, something like that. Yeah, fascinating guy. I spent quite a bit of time with him in London when he visited once, and I want to go out to New York to spend some more time with him. He's fascinating. But he said to me, because he's a qualified psychologist or therapist in one area, and he said that when you're stood waiting to go on, you can feel those nerves building. That chemical reaction in your body is almost identical to what it would be if you were really excited about something. And the only difference is the way your brain perceives it, in terms of one tells you it's nerves and the other one tells you it's excitement. You're essentially telling yourself you're nervous because of what's about to happen. So he says, try and change that mindset. Try and tell yourself that you're excited and you're not nervous, and see how that works. So for the next few months, I was really looking forward to this. I'm going to go out. They're going to enjoy it. Everything's going to go right, and I'm not going to fluff my lines up or anything like that. And it did start to work. You know, 6 weeks in, you've done maybe sort of, even if you've only done sort of five shows in that time, but you still start to think, wow, I don't feel that. I am quite as nervous, and I'm actually looking forward to the gig tonight, as opposed to, oh God, I've got to go and get ready now, and I've got to go for a drive. And, you know, you could feel the palpitations and what have you. So yeah, start to convince yourself that you're excited. And really, you are excited, because it's you what's made that choice to go and be a magician or a mentalist. You want to share it with the world. So you are. I think you just need a reminding and pulling back a little bit, because everyone can go a bit crazy when emotion and stress gets involved.
And what about choice of material? Is there a massive difference? Again, a question I get an awful lot is, I want to perform on stage. Can I do the same stuff that I do close up? And one thing that, and again, I'm not a stage mentalist, but one thing I've noticed from seeing a lot of mentalists that perform on stage is, a lot of the time, they'll fill an entire theater with a couple of billets. Like, can close up mentalism work on stage, or do you have to get a whole different sort of set of routines, or is it more about learning how to actually deliver it on stage, as opposed to, you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, absolutely. The way I've always seen the role of a mental, or not the role, but a mentalist, and it'd be the same for a magician, I'm sure this would translate. I have a toolbox. It's just a metaphorical toolbox, but in it, it's every weird skill or technique I've learned. So there's cold reading in there, there's muscle reading, there's my understanding of equivoque and magician's choice and things like that. But then there's tangible things. There's like a thumb writer, or a physical skill, being able to pocket write or to switch a billet or something like that. And it's my role to be able to come into a venue and to take the tools in this toolbox to then be able to create a show or create a live performance, a live experience for the audience. So I try not to think of it as the tricks that I'm going to do. Can I still do the same tricks? But can I still demonstrate the same skill? So if I, one of my powers, let's say, as a mentalist is that I got really good at reading people, whether that's, you know, we've all heard of poker faces, that kind of thing, being able to read people, to discern elements. You know, I can't tell you what you're thinking if you're just saying it in your mind, but I might be able to tell you how you're feeling at a certain point, you know, that kind of thing. So if I can still demonstrate that ability to read people close up and read people on stage, great. Another skill is the ability to influence a thought. So if I can create that illusion of mind reading by influencing you without you even being aware of it, then I'm still doing that same job. So if I can do that close up and if I can do that on stage, and yes, the demonstration, the props you use and the overall picture that you're painting is different, then, you know, I think it's important that you've got to be consistent with that, with what you're demonstrating, and try not to approach building a show as, oh, I've got this new prop in, or I've got this new trick in that I want to do. So to highlight that, I do a fourth dimensional telepathy on my show, the three envelope routine, you know, famous sort of Anneman, and then Cassidy made it his. So I do that in my show, but I still do elements of that close up, but not the whole routine. So I might reveal the name of a teacher from someone when they were younger, using the same kind of presentation. So that's sort of thing. Let me just, excuse me a second. I know it's very nothing, but I believe my fiance has just turned up. She's wanting if I can let her back in the house. Now I think, are you here, Nick? Right, okay. Perfect. Sorry about that. Craig?
I'm here, mate. No problem. I'm just awesome. Take this to mommy. Tell her that Russ Brown has called 6 times and tell her to call him back. Yeah. To go, Ryland's off sick today, so he's in my office. So
brilliant, doing his thing. now Nick's been for an interview.
Yeah, so we'll cut this out, so that's not a problem. We'll cut that bit out. So, do you want to carry on from what you were talking about, or do you want me to ask a question again?
No, I can carry on.
Yeah, I think we covered it. So let's carry on, because we've talked about you performing, talked about you transitioning from sort of wedding magic to corporate magic. We've talked about a whole plethora of subjects, but one thing that really fascinates me is you as a creator, because that's a big element of how people in the magic community might know you now. You create a lot of material. Now, some people might not be aware of that, because unlike most creators in this industry, you don't put your material through Murphy's a lot of the time. So the only way to get hold of what you do, and by the way, some of the best mentalism I've ever seen has been created by you, and the only way you can actually get that is by following you and being a part of your mailing list. I want to talk to you a little bit about that aspect of your sort of your career. And I suppose the first question is, what made you decide to be a creator in the first place? Because, and let's make no bones about it, you're very, very successful. You went full time. And as you say, you already had a business set up there. You've never had a problem getting work, very well paid work, very high end work. It wasn't because you wanted the money. So what made you decide to start creating mentalism and releasing it to the community?
Yeah, it was an interesting thing, because I always put myself on the side of a creative than an academic. I wasn't particularly the cleverest person at school, but I always enjoyed drawing and making things and what have you. And my sort of degree is in product design. So I've always naturally had a pencil in my hand, sketching and coming up with things. But whenever I would buy a routine or a book, or even when DVDs were coming out, or even VHS and things like that, you know, I would look at a routine and I'd go, oh, I can do that. I'd like to do that. But I'd never think of doing it as it was done on the release. It was always, how can I do that? What would I do to it? And I've never had that idea of being able to buy something. And when you hear people, I'm doing it, I buy it in the afternoon, I'm doing it that night. Never interested me, because I would rather be able to think about that and think, well, what can I do with that? It's a really nice routine. The patter's there and it works for the performer, but it probably won't work for me in that way. So I would, anything I bought, I was always changing. I'd be sketching little things down, or like, how would I change the presentation, or do I need to change one of the props maybe? And by the end of it, I kind of changed it completely. So it was like, oh, that was the starting point, but this is where it's finished. So I found that all the material that I was doing, or at least the presentations that I were doing, were my presentations. And I thought, I kind of like to share those as well. So the very first thing that I released was back in 2006, and it was with Alakazam. It was a book called SAD. It stood for Simple and Direct Mentalism. I was 25 when I writ it, and I'm not the academic, so it was littered with, you know, spelling, grammatical errors and things like that. And I just sent it over to Peter just for some advice. And I was like, these are some of my routines. Like, what do you think? And I didn't know whether I was even going to get a message back. But within a couple of days, I got a phone call from Peter who said that, yeah, do you know what? We want to put this out. So my head was kind of blown at that point, because it was my first time at writing something up. So that became a release. Realistically, what we should have done is like, right, Peter, you probably should get it spell checked, get it looked at, because, you know, I'm rubbish at writing. It went out as the PDF went. So this book got produced, and I love them. I still love the material in it. Some of the routines that I do to this day are still in that book. But it kind of got shat on a little bit, because some people couldn't see past the atrocious grammatical errors in it. And I have to sort of just hold my hands up to that, because it was just, you know, a kid. It was never supposed to get released as a book. It was sent as a PDF for advice. And then I got caught up in this, oh my God, they want to release the book. And next minute it's out, and people are sort of starting to hear about my name. Then a couple of years later, we did a DVD with, it was with Alakazam, but it wasn't. It was with Inner Mind Productions, which is, if you can remember, it was Peter Nardi and Mark Spellman.
They had that separate company for a while. That was
So that came out. We went and filmed a DVD down at, I think it was Eastwood Manor or something. All the Alakazam DVDs at that time were being done at this venue. So you knew, and I think Peter told everybody it was his house for a few years, because it looked like some grand stately home. It was great. And that was it, really. I got the creative bug, and I took everything that I had learned. And we were talking about this. There's no real booklet to teach you how to transition to go full time, or what to do at certain gigs and things like that. So everything that I'd learned and made notes of, it's one of my pet things. I always write down things and just keep a list of things that I'm working on, or ideas and what have you. I decided to put into a book. So it was a self-produced book called The Black Project. And it was 10 years of me starting out as a mentalist, getting my first gig, to then being at the point where I made that transition to being a full-time mentalist. And that book documented that. And I remember it cost me a fortune to self-publish it. It was 2 volumes in a slipcase, all leather-bound. It looked amazing. And we had 400 of them done, and we sold them for 250 quid each. And people went mental. They were like, why are you charging this much for a book? And I was like, okay, I can explain. And when I explained, people accepted it. And that was my first ever gig that I did 10 years ago, or longer than that, but back then it would have been. I got paid 250 quid to go and do a close-up gig by a guy who'd never heard of me. And he appeared me for 2 hours of my time. Everything that I've learned since then in those 10 years, I've put into this book. So I'm hoping that you would feel that that's a fair price to pay for 10 years worth of work. And when people heard that, they were like, actually, yeah, I understand it from that point of view. So it ended up selling out. It became that book of the year for the Tarbell thing, what they do on the Tragic Cafe. And it enabled me to then set up Read My Mind Limited, which is, as you say, my online store. I wanted to have an outlet where I could release things, like a creative outlet to be able to put things through. And at the same time, I didn't really have a full plan of what I wanted to do with it. I just wanted the outlet there as and when, so I could be able to release things to the community. So that was the start of it. And Murphy's, Penguin, you start getting the calls, you get the emails. And I remember I went out to Columbus to do I've been out there three times to do three different live lectures over the years, and it's almost 10 years ago, the first one. So it was in 2013, and Penguin wanted to work with me. Murphy's did. They wanted to pick up some of the products that I put out. But then when we talk numbers, it was really eye-opening for me. And as a creator, but also understanding that I'm actually the brand as well. Like people will buy things based on, because it's got my name attached to it, which sounds really sort of big-headed, but I mean, like having 10 years of releasing things to the community, I've built up a fairly decent list of loyal customers that are looking out for things of mine. So I thought to myself, well, I could do this with them and you would earn peanuts, let's say. And it was a business decision to think, well, hang on, if I retain all that control, I worry about the manufacturing, I worry about the testing, the prototyping, but get it how I want it, and it's my hands-on. Because with it being my company, I can go and drive to, you know, I've got a plastics worker who lives 10 miles from here, I've got a woodworker, I've got 3D printers, but I've built a relationship and a network up with all these people, and I'm supporting their business as well, and it's all done locally. I say all done, there's still some things that we can't get done locally at the moment, but they are changing. So it's good to have people like Alan Wong as a contact over in Hong Kong who can find things made as well and shipped over. But even things like that now is not working that well because the cost of shipping and things like that is so outrageously high. It's actually offsetting what you would save originally to get it actually built in Britain. So that's kind of good for our economy as well. But I'm going off on a tangent. So I've decided to retain all that control because I wanted people to come to me. Because I'm thinking to myself, a creator who's put thousands of hours of thought into it, plus risking his own financial money by, you know, I trust my product that much, I'm going to invest 10 grand to get it made. That's a big statement. And you can only do that if you're confident behind the material, which I think breaks down to, do you actually do the material? So a lot of things that I was seeing get released, you could see they've never done that before. They've done that to release it to make some money. Whereas I wanted to have my own company that I just released the stuff that I did myself. So it was a choice to try to create, I don't want to say like a little boutique shop, but an independent shop that actually practice what it's preached, if that makes sense, without sounding awful in any way.
That makes absolute sense. And how often do you release material through? Read my mind.
I would say on average maybe two effects a year. So our most recent effect was a routine. It was actually my first ever stand-up routine I created. It's a routine called The Lineup, which is kind of like a hybrid of a lot of classics in mentalism. So if you're a fan of like Sneak Thief or A Chair Test, that kind of thing, it's a fusion of those two ideas with a nice sort of kicker prediction at the end that you can customize for the client. So I decided to put this out because I must have performed it, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times. And over those years, it's changed completely. Like when I said to you at the start, we look at a routine that I bought, and then by the time I've customized it and presented it, it doesn't look anything like the original thing. That's kind of what's happened with The Lineup. So it's gone through so many iterations. It's at the point now where I've got it exactly how I want it and how I perform it in my own show. So I thought, right, well, that now's the time to release just a few of them. So we had 150 sets made, which came out and almost all gone. So I don't sell huge amounts, but, you know, it's always good to have that control over what you've got and to be able to say and put out what you want to put out. So, like, sometimes working with Penguin's great. You might sell 1,000 of something, or, you know, Murphy's might get 3,000 of something sold, which is fantastic if you want to do that. But that's 3,000 people that are using your idea. It doesn't really turn me on, that idea. I quite like the idea of, you know, something that is a little bit more. I don't want to see the mentalists going out and everyone doing the same trick. And that sort of kind of was driven home to me by Alex McClear, who spoke to an agent, and he was trying to explain what a mentalist does. And she was saying, well, what is a mentalist? And he said, well, I just kind of do mind reading things and what have you. And she said, oh, are you like those guys that stand up on stage and there's five of them and they each have a board and they've drawn something and you tell them what they've drawn? And she just basically described Sneak Thief And that's an agent in the member of public who's seen so many mentalists do that trick that that's naturally what they think of a mentalist is. So I thought, no, I need to kind of have a bit more control over it. And you know, if we just do 100, that's just 100 people that can do it. And then at least it's not everyone's doing the same kind of lazy sort of crap that we unfortunately see sometimes. Not say too much.
That's amazing. No. I really like that's such a great attitude to have. Like, it really is, because you know as well as me, if you went knocking on Penguin's door or Murphy's door and you said, hey, I've got this new trick, they would bite your hand off. They'd say, yeah, I'll take 500, I'll take 1,000, I'll take whatever, because like you said, your brand, people will buy what it is that you put out. But the fact that you're one of the reasons for keeping it limited is to protect mentalism. I mean, that's such a great attitude. It really is.
It almost sounds stupid. For some people might think it's stupid, and it's not the sort of conscious thing. Like, the way you've worded that is very specific. And it, when I think about it, I think, like, actually, that is kind of what I'm doing, but I never set out to do that. Because it almost sounds a little bit like he's up his own arse a little bit. And I certainly don't want it to come across like that. But I care about mentalism. And I think a lot of people that are interested in mentalism, they don't understand the fundamental difference between the two. And I think if they did, they wouldn't make the decisions that they do sometimes by merging certain things, or, you know, doing a coin matrix and then going into a drawing duplication or something like that. Because I think, yes, Joe Public see it as entertainment, they see it, it's all magic. And I think it's very difficult to differentiate yourself. But the fundamental skills of what you're trying to do should appear as if that's what you're trying to do. So a coin matrix is, for me, if I was presenting it, I would try and present it as an act of misdirection. I'm going to misdirect you throughout this and you won't catch me doing it. And it becomes a game where you're trying to sort of, you know, you're appreciating the physical skill and the dexterity and being able to sort of almost be like a con man in that, you know, the three shell game, that sort of thing. Whereas if a mentalist says, well, you know, I'm gonna read, not necessarily read your mind, but I'm going to read elements from you, which will give me enough information to then hopefully, like a jigsaw puzzle, I'm going to put it back together and work out what you've drawn. It's two completely different skills. And I don't necessarily think that they merge that well. You know, I don't. So it's a personal opinion, but it is what it is.
Well, I want to ask you one more question about creating, but before I do, on that subject, you said that you started creating magic because you were creating your own presentations for tricks, and we've spoken about how a lot of mentalists do the same thing and so on and so forth. My question is, how as a mentalist do you stand out from everybody else? How do you stand out? Because I see, you know, many years ago, I've been in this industry a long time, I remember seeing so many Max Maven clones. And then when Derren hit the airwaves, I saw so many Derren Brown clones, so many people going, it's psychological, it's influence. It's, how do you become your own character? How do you stand?
It's the kind of thing that you would want to be able to bottle it and sell it if you could find out, you know, work it all out. For me, there's trends. Everything goes full circle. So that when Derren came out, that was the vast majority of people, especially in the UK's first exposure to mentalism. So for a lot of younger people that are inspired by it, that look up to, you know, and have inspirations to do that kind of thing, oh, I want to do that, then it would be a natural thing to look towards somebody like a key figure like Derren, see all the specials and all his TV work and think that's how it's done. So naturally, you take elements of that. I mean, I've seen people use the jokes Derren's done. I've seen people have this. You remember when Derren had this tick when he was nodding all the time? I've seen people manufacture that into a presentation. And I'm like, you know, you would be great as a Derren Brown tribute act. Like, you'll clean up doing it. But like, it's just too forced. You can tell you've tried to take something and make it your own that much. It's no longer natural. It was natural in Derren's hands because that's him doing it, but you're trying to be him. So I don't see anything wrong with being inspired by an act or the way you are, the way you dress, your persona, that kind of thing. There's nothing wrong with that. Whilst you're finding yourself, and I think it's going to take you a number of years to find yourself doing gigs on a regular basis, learning your material, how to speak to people, how to be you before you actually become comfortable in your own skin to be you. And there lies one of the problems at the moment, where there's so many people trying to find themselves, but there's so many almost like magnets pulling them in certain directions. So do I want to be like the propless mentalism? That's huge over the past few years. Me, not a fan of it. I see the beauty in something so simple and elegant, but as a realist and be able to apply that into a real world gig, it's in my gigs, let's say, where I've got people who've had a drink around me, it's very loud and things like that. I can't take a lot of that and apply it because it doesn't work. Not for those audiences at that time. They're too drunk or it's too procedure heavy, let's say. Other people are being pulled into sort of, I want to be a mystery entertainer. It almost feels like they're trying to be a therapist sometimes by giving them advice on life. And I think, well, there's enough room in mentalism for everything. You know, if we're all the same, it'd all be giantly boring. But I think people have got to have a little bit of caution when they are trying to do things that they're inspired by. Because if not, you're just running the risk of just being a clone of everyone else. Yeah, the idea of being able to be good at influence, you know, it didn't start with Darren. It didn't start with Dunninger. I mean, it goes back. There are only a finite way of presenting a certain mental flavored trick, and you've got to sort of find what works within you and what's natural to you. So if you are, you know, people always say that you're a really good listener, you've always got the best advice, then you use that, use a real skill that you're good at, to then try and exaggerate and help you become a mentalist in that way. I'm working with a young person at the moment who I'm mentoring, and he wants to work as like an empath who feels people and can pick up on emotions. So that's what the line he's trying to go down, and we're trying to sort of actively encourage that and to avoid being inspired by what's current and what's trendy at the time. So there's always going to be your own way. It's just once you're comfortable in your own skin with your own experience and your own confidence, I think that's when you will start to look back and think, actually, I have changed and things are a little bit different in the way I perceive and perform and present the mentalism. And I think even if I was to be honest myself, if I look back at those early DVDs with Alakazam, yeah, I think I was heavily inspired by Darren, because that was the as a sort of an impressionable 25-year-old guy who's like getting into it, and you're seeing Darren on TV, you can't not be inspired by him. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think there's a time and a time when you sort of mature as an actor, and you realize that you do things your own way. And you might not even be conscious of it. It might have been one of those sort of light bulb moments 10 years in the time and go, shit, when did that happen? How have I become and evolved into this kind of performer now? So you might surprise yourself, I think, as well. Not you, but you know what I mean? People will surprise themselves.
Yeah, that's really a perfect answer to that question. And one last question about the creativity. How, I've talked about various different questions I get on this channel, and one of the biggest questions is, I want to be a creator. How can I create my own routines? I think I've talked about this before, but I think that when people come into this industry, a lot of the time we put creators on pedestals. Mm. I want to be that guy. I want to have my name on a box in every magic shop around the world. And so many people have that burning desire to be a creator. Any advice on being a creator, or whether it's even worth it, or like how the process that you should go through to create something?
It's like, can you teach creativity? It's a whole area, isn't it, of study? Like, is it the sort of, some people are naturally more gifted with it, being able to sort of take apart an idea and inject new life into it, and that's great. Some people struggle with it. And I think, you know, if you want to set out to be a creator, I think you've already got to have a huge understanding of magic and theory and moves and sleights and things like that. Because again, you're arming yourself with it's your vocab, I suppose. It's your ABC to be able to use something and communicate it to the world in a different way. So do I have advice for it? I think one, you should be of a level of maturity as a human being before you really start to be comfortable to be able to create, because you, when you force something, you're often like, if you sit down and say, right, I'm going to create a routine that does this, like you've got effect, like in a book, when you've got effect and you've painted the effect as a paragraph, and now you've got to create the method. I think it's a whole wrong way of doing it. You know, people start with, I've got a really cool method that I want to use for this, or I've got a nice idea for a trick, but I haven't got the method for it. I think that's probably the better way if you did it, you know, to have that end goal in mind. But the problem is that a lot of people are creating because they want to put out, they want to get their face on screen. It's changed over the past 10 years. Like for me, it was about getting in a book or releasing something like that. But people, I think a lot of people want exposure. They want their face on the camera. They want people following them. They want to get those likes. And really, they don't want to be a creator. They just want to be popular and be liked. So yeah, you can go out and put whatever you want. I remember all the eBooks that came out years ago, everybody was putting eBooks out because it's cheap. It's free. Anyone can do it. So if you want to go out and put material on a YouTube channel and you want to get lots of likes, you can do that and not really be a creator. All you've got to be is consistent and have that sort of love to do it. If you're putting a video out every day, a couple of videos out every day, you're going to get the traction at some point, unless you're truly terrible. But to be a creator takes time. I always try and talk about, like, you know, like a fine wine will take time to mature. A good sauce needs time to marinate. I think a good idea needs time to marinate. And I think you need to sit and think about that idea for a lot, apply what you're thinking and go out into the real world and actually try it and then evaluate it. And to be honest with yourself, if something's not working, then what do I need to change? It might not be the mechanics. It might be the way I am, the way I'm presenting it, what I'm saying, how I'm coming across. So really all that comes with time, experience and consistency. And don't try and force it, because I don't think being creative is an art. There's an art form around the whole idea of being able to take one idea and translate that into something that's incredible, that everyone can go and sort of learn and perform and apply themselves. You can't do that in a day. They say Rome wasn't built in a day. I don't think any routine is. I think it takes time. So don't rush it. But it's at odds with what you want. A lot of people want to be, you know, have their own faces, their own channels, and they want to be popular. So can you really be a creator and be a celeb within magic for better reasons? Maybe you can, maybe you can't. I don't know. It's not really my thing that I'm interested in, but I would rather spend 10 years on a routine and getting it where I'm really happy with it than forcing something out to get a few likes and a bit of money. I hope that answers your question.
No, it really does. It really does.
I feel like the grumpy old man.
Not at all. Well, look, if somebody's never seen your work before, but they're into mentalism or they want to become more into mentalism, and I'm going to put a link at the bottom in the description so they can visit your online shop. What would you say would be the best thing for them to buy that gives you a good idea of the type of mentalism that you produce and gives them a flavor of the type of stuff that you do?
Oh, crikey. Because a lot of the stuff that I'm releasing now tends to be routines or a tool itself. So if I release a wallet, it's a tool. Whereas if I release a routine, then that's a snapshot of one particular routine, and it might be one line of thinking. To get like a breadth of understanding of where I'm coming from, I think go back to the first book, Sad. If you can get yourself through the spelling errors and the grammar, it's not that bad. I am shitting on it myself somewhat, but I can. But that will show you the types of thinking behind it when I was young. And I don't think a lot of that sort of fundamentals change much. So if you like that back then, I think you'll like some of the more modern stuff. But I would definitely go to maybe one of the Penguin lectures. That'll give you a good sense of it. The first one, Penguin Live one, that'll be a good one. If you can get hold of the Black Project, I mean, they do change hands for about 500 quid these days, and that is crazy. But that's good. I think it does keep it quite exclusive to a limited audience. That will give you the whole 10 years of my thinking in that sort of sense. There's a diary in there, a diary of when I was at an event and something happened, and I tended not to focus on the positives. I would always look at the negatives. Something went wrong, something weird happened, what did I learn from that? There's also a couple of cases of me being sexually abused in there by drunken women as well. But there's some great stories in there, like some really interesting stories. And when you read through them, you can kind of see the sort of progression of how things have changed over the years with it. But in terms of existing things on the website right now, the lineup I'm very proud of because it has been 10 years of thinking. So you'll go out, and what I'm noticing is a lot of people are getting in touch with me saying, I've gone out, I've performed this for the first time and I can't believe the reaction I'm getting. And I don't think that's me saying, yeah, because this idea is better than what you were doing before. But I think there's a lot of things that were ironed out and worked out in there to allow you to relax a little bit and rely on the method will work. You focus on being yourself out there and communicating and getting a bit of a laugh and engaging with your audience. So it's allowing you to focus on that because the method's almost self-working. So that'd be a good routine for people to look into. I'm trying to think what else is on there at the moment. I think you reviewed Places, didn't you? The postcards.
It's amazing. I love Places. Really great.
You know, I can give you a background about that. There's a story behind it because it was never supposed to be postcards. In a way, postcards takes away from the organic nature of it. What it was is I had a stack of index cards and I had a load of people write down different places from all over. And then I created the forcing banks myself. But it was supposed to be like an emergency routine that I would keep in a little file box, like a little postcard sized box that went in my case. And I knew that if I had a repeat audience, I could just bust this out and do a three phase routine that would replace my fourth dimensional telepathy, because I'm replacing one routine that's three phases, uses three different people, for another one. And really the beauty behind the original places was, even though I would be forcing a number of destinations or places onto the people, because no one is aware that you actually know them, I could then get them to make a free association of something to do with that place. So, for example, in Places, one of them is Tokyo, and all the postcards have sushi on them. But if it was just an index card that said the word Tokyo on, and I said, and you were thinking of that place, and I could say, Craig, have you ever been there before? And you would say yes, no, or whatever, and say, okay, imagine yourself there. And let's say that you're in a local restaurant eating the kind of food, you know, the traditional food that you would expect to have out there. Can you just maybe get that in mind? Perfect. So now you know that you can go into the sort of sushi noodles, that sort of thing. So, but their leap in their head from, right, I've got Tokyo here, can you think of something to eat? Oh yeah, hang on, what would I have? They've gone through the thought process themselves to decide on what they want to go with, as opposed to having it spoon-fed them on the actual face of the postcard because it has a sushi roll on or something like that. So I had to lose one element, what I really liked. And I found that when I first started to do it with the postcards, the reaction wasn't quite the same. So that's why I had to change a few things in there. And one of the ideas was to get the postcards marked, which then gives you this freedom of anyone can supposedly take one. And with a little glance, I would know where they're thinking. And then having them also to start, like, look at the place. Have you been there? No. Would you like to go there? Great. Plan a trip in your head. Imagine what you would do there. So now it's all very personal in their head. But because I know what it is, I'm always going to get the hit. So that's the story behind Places. It was never supposed to be that, but it was a creative exercise of creating something that looked so quirky and so cool, let's say, in tactile with the little suitcase, that I wanted to see how many people would get it. And I only had, I think, 200 of them done, and they went. So I was quite chuffed with it. It looked lovely. It was a really nice, I was very proud of the look. And that's down to really, obviously my input, but working with Phil Smith. Good friends with Phil, and he's genius.
I'm interviewing Phil in 2 days' time. I've worked with him on a couple of projects. He's brilliant. Incredible.
Yeah, I love the guy. And he always nails the brief. If you come to him and say, look, I've got this kind of idea, and he said, right, let me go away. And he does the same thing. He lets it marinate. He doesn't rush through it. He sits and thinks about it, and then we'll reconvene, and boom, he's usually nailed it with an idea. So I actually found an old suitcase with all the stickers on. It just looked like it. And I sent him a photograph in a shop, an antique shop. I said, that's what we need for places. And that was the starting point for it. So
right.
It was a good, fun project to do.
And you ship worldwide. So anybody who, and it's a good idea to get on your mailing list, because that your stuff, without being salesy, and this is not about being salesy, your stuff goes quickly. When it's gone, you don't reprint it. I know you've had tons of questions. Are you going to reprint the Black Project? Are you going to, you just don't do it. It's like when it's gone and it goes quick.
So the latest one, they wanted it translated into French and releasing it again in French, but not interested. Like if I'm going to make a promise or a commitment to my customers, I'm not going to then do that commitment and then just say, oh, I'll stuff it now. I need a bit more money this month. I'll just release it again. That's a slap in their face. I'm about building a relationship up with them over a period of time, because they're on that same adventure with me. They're just doing their own thing in their own countries or their own cities. We're all in it together. So just bring me back to the question again, Craig, sorry.
You ship worldwide. It was basically just saying you ship worldwide and people get on your mailing list.
If we go to readmymind.co.uk, just have a browse around, a pop-up will come up. At some point, that's how it's trained to do it. It's a very good little pop-up. And he's just going to ask you for your email address, and in exchange, he's going to give you 10% off for your first order. So that's how I get my email list. I try to send out one email per week, and the email is usually a story of something that's happened at a gig. So I'm basically giving them a diary of my mind-reading adventures. Like, so, for example, this week I'm going to be talking about the event that we did together. So, and then I can tie it in, obviously, with saying I did the interview. Check out Craig's interview on Saturday. So I'm trying to sort of let people know what else is going on around the sort of my kind of connected world, if that makes sense. But yeah, we ship all over the world. It's always secure track shipping. And we've just had a Black Friday sale, so we had to fill up the van yesterday and send those out. So that's just finished today, so you're not going to get the sale, but you will get 10% off your if you first order, if you sign up.
That's great. And, you know, before I ask you one final question, the one thing that I've noticed throughout the whole of this interview is how important it is for you to build up relationships. We started off talking about the gig that we did, and you talked about building a relationship with the photographer to hopefully lead to more work down the line. We talked about wedding fairs, where you talked about speaking to other suppliers to build up relationships. We talked about you building relationships up with local suppliers to create products for you. And you've just talked about building relationships up with your customers and not screwing them up. You can, it's not been a conscious thing, but that comes across over and over again during this interview, how That's important good. Relationship marketing is for you and how important it is networking and building up relationships. And that just shows you the type of person you
100%.
Are.
100%. I think without, well, for all the guys and girls that are going to be watching, and they're in a position where they might not be getting many shows, and that sort of element of jealousy might creep in, and you look at people and you're seeing people celebrating an event that they're at, and they're getting lots of likes and comments, you can start to be a little bit bitter and resentful if you're not careful. And I think what you should do is look at the contacts that you've got, look at the relationships that you're currently nurturing, and then look at, like, everybody. Who do I see on, it's Facebook, Paul Martin. I always see posts of Paul, and he is here, there and everywhere. He's in Norway, he's doing this, doing that, and he's got loads of people commenting. And I think to myself, right, what's Paul doing really, really well? He's taking those relationships that he's built, and he's kind of harnessing them and then nurturing them. And as a result, all these people are talking about Paul, and they're doing the advertising for him. It's because he's built up those relationships and worked his ass off doing that way. And I think a lot of people, before you might start looking and getting a little bit jealous, and it's easy to do when you're young, you're impressionable, you're trying to start out, is look at the hard work and the graft that they've done. And this is no shortcut to success. It's a long game. And it's a long game that the only people responsible is yourself and the way you treat people. Because the way you treat people will reflect on who you are as a performer, who you are as a business, and whether people want to work with you or not. So building relationships is absolutely key to any kind of longevity and success in this industry.
Absolutely. Completely agree. Great advice. One final question, then we wrap it up. And the final question is, we've talked about your career. You're incredibly successful in everything that you've done. Your creations have been performed all over the world. You as a performer, everything you've done is so successful. Is there anything left on your magical stroke mentalism bucket list that you'd like to achieve that you haven't done yet? Is there any goal that you're shooting for that you haven't yet hit, that you're hoping to hit? Or are you kind of just in a position where you're like, you know what, things have gone really well and I just want more of the same?
It's really interesting that you say it, because hearing you say that about you're very successful, you've achieved a lot. In my head, my mindset is, I don't feel like I've achieved much at all. I feel that everything else that I want to achieve is still out there ready to go on. And it's probably my fuel, my driving to sort of push out there. I suffer from imposter syndrome. In fact, you did a video. I'm sure it popped up on my feed the other day. We're talking about that. I haven't seen it yet, but I will watch that video because I suffer from that. And I feel that there's so much more that I want to do in terms of, I mean, who was it who said it? Ray Charles. He said he never wanted to be famous. He just wants to be great. He always wanted to be the best at what he did. And that's kind of been my mindset. I've never been one for him being in front of a camera. I never feel like comfortable on the camera. So the idea of going and doing sort of TV work, if you ask the 25-year-old Lucha, that might be like, oh, yeah, I'd like my own TV special. Now the thought of that scares the hell out of me. I'm like, no, I don't want that. I just want to be able to wake up, to go and be able to perform and earn a living doing what I love and to be as good as I can be at it. But I think we can often focus on an end goal, a target to reach and things like that. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if you don't necessarily have an end goal, you just want to be good at what you do, then enjoy the journey. Because often it's all those little things, those little wins that when you look back and reflect upon, you think, actually, that is all that what led me to be here right now. And it was Richard Osterlund who told me that. And I think at the time I was too focused on, doing a specific thing. Like, I want to just do corporate work, or I just want to have a stage show, or I want people to book me and pay me 10 grand for an event, that kind of thing. Great to have those targets. But what about the first time that you made £1,000 on a show? Like, if talk to the 20-year-old kid then and say, would you go out for £1,000 and show and do that every week? Yeah, of course I would. Well, what about the next time when you got 4,000? That was my next jump up. I remember I got 4,000 for an event. It was a trade show, but it was a couple of days. But I remember thinking, wow, can you imagine doing that every month? Just doing like one trade show and a couple of corporates and wow, all of a sudden I'm making nearly 10 grand a month. Oh, then that would be great. But if you look back on all those little steps, and that is those steps to those targets, and I think you shouldn't forget those. I think you should live in the moment. You should appreciate everything that you've got at that particular time and use it to drive you on to the next stage and do it incrementally. You're in for the long haul and enjoy your bloody journey, because we are privileged. We're all very lucky to be able to go and do this, because it's what we fell in love with and what we decided to share with the world. So I think you should always remind yourself of that. And when you're having a bad day or you're pissed off that someone's getting more gigs than you and that kind of thing, just do your own journey, focus on yourself and be nice to people.
You know what? That is the best advice I've ever heard. And that's incredible. What a wonderful way to end the interview. And I'll tell you something, Luch. I mentioned this to you off camera. This is the 200th interview on
Great
Magic.
Yeah, you're longevity. Number 200. There you go. Look at you.
And this has been one of my favorites. Like, I've always been a fan of your work. We don't really know each other too well, but I've always been a fan of you on social media, a fan of your work. I've always been a huge fan. But having a chance to sit down and chat to you and hear your thinking about various different subjects, I'm an even bigger fan. Like, it's been incredible. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's very, very nice to hear. It's warming.
Oh, no. It's amazing. And what I want everyone to do that's listening to this right now is leave a comment down below so that Luch can read them and let him know what you thought of the interview. And more importantly, wherever you are around the world, do me a favor. There's going to be a link down below. Jump onto... give me the website now. Let's read it out loud. It's www.readmymind.co.uk.
readmymind.co.uk. Go on there, look for that pop-up, put in your email address. It's definitely worth it, because this is a gentleman that doesn't spam you, but will send you information on stuff that's very hard to get hold of if you don't grab it there and then. And I believe in supporting people that are doing an amazing job, and Luch is definitely one of those. So thanks so much. One last question. Where can people follow you on social media?
I'm at Luch Mind Reader on pretty much all the socials. I'm more regular on Instagram and LinkedIn. But if you want to follow me on, it's a strange one, because I try to keep them separate, but I would often find magicians and mentalists liking Luch Mind Reader and replying to like threads aimed at the public. Like, oh, I love your switch. And I'm like, oh, that's for the public. So that's why I created Read My Mind. But if people want to follow me, jump on Luch Mind Reader. If you're interested in my products, jump on readmymind.co.uk. That's it. That's as clear as I can be.
That's amazing. That's amazing. One more time, congratulations on all your success. And thank you so much for a wonderful interview.
I appreciate you. And long may the show continue for the next 200.
Oh my God. Yeah, here's open. Guys, on behalf of Luch, thanks very much. I'll see you again with another video. But thanks for tuning in to Talk Magic right here on Magic TV.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast. Magic. Be sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel. Magic TV. Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV, or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.